Chapter 4 Rosewater County, the canvas Elliot proposed to paint with love and understanding, was a rectangle on which other men, other Rosewaters mainly, had already made some bold designs. Elliot's predecessors had anticipated Mondrian. Half the roads ran east and west, and half the roads ran north and south. Bisecting the county exactly, and stopping at its borders, was a stagnant canal 14 miles long. It was the one dash of reality added by Elliot's great-grandfather to a stock-and-bond fantasy of a canal that would join Chicago, Indianapolis, Rosewater, and the Ohio. There were now bullheads, crappies, red-eyes, bluegills, and carp in the canal. It was to people interested in catching such fish that nightcrawlers were sold. The ancestors of many of the nightcrawler merchants had been stockholders and bondholders in the Rosewater Interstate Ship Canal. When the scheme failed utterly, some of them lost their farms, which were bought by Noah Rosewater. A utopian community in the southwest corner of the county, New Ambrosia, invested everything it had in the canal and lost. They were Germans, communists, and atheists who practiced group marriage, absolute truthfulness, absolute cleanliness, and absolute love. They were now scattered to the winds, like the worthless papers that represented their equity in the canal. No one was sorry to see them go. Their one contribution to the county that was still viable in Elliot's time was their brewery, which had become the home of Rosewater Golden Lager Ambrosia Beer. On the label of each can of beer was a picture of the heaven on earth the new Ambrosians had meant to build. The Dream City had spires. The spires had lightning rods. The sky was filled with cherubim. The town of Rosewater was in the dead center of the county. In the dead center of town was a Parthenon built of honest red brick, columns and all. Its roof was green copper. The canal ran through it, and so, in the bustling past, had the New York Central, Monon, and Nickel Plate Railroads. When Elliot and Sylvia took up residence, only the canal and the Monon tracks remained, and the Monon was bankrupt, and its tracks were brown. To the west of the Parthenon was the old Rosewater Saw Company, red brick, too, green-roofed, too. The spine of its roof was broken, its windows unglazed. It was a new ambrosia for barn swallows and bats. Its four tower clocks were handless. Its big brass whistle was choked with nests. To the east of the Parthenon was the county courthouse, red brick, too, green-roofed, too. Its tower was identical with that of the old saw company. Three of its four clocks still had their hands, but they did not run. Like an abscess at the base of a dead tooth, a private business had somehow managed to establish itself in the cellar of the public building. It had a little red neon sign, Bella's Beauty Nook, it said. Bella weighed 314 pounds. To the east of the courthouse was the Samuel Rosewater Veterans Memorial Park. It had a flagpole and an honor roll. The honor roll was a 4x8 sheet of exterior plywood painted black. It was hung on pipe, sheltered by a gable that was only 2 inches wide. It had all the names of Rosewater County people who had laid down their lives for their country. The only other masonry structures were the Rosewater Mansion and its carriage house, set on an artificial elevation at the east end of the park and surrounded by a rank of iron spikes, and the Noah Rosewater Memorial High School, home of the Fighting Sawmakers, which bounded the park on the south. To the north of the park was the old Rosewater Opera House, a terrifyingly combustible frame wedding cake which had been converted to a firehouse. All else was shithouses, shacks, alcoholism, ignorance, idiocy, and perversion. For all that was healthy and busy and intelligent in Rosewater County shunned the county seat. The new Rosewater Saw Company, all yellow brick and no windows, was set in a cornfield midway between Rosewater and New Ambrosia. It was served by a gleaming new spur of the New York Central and by a sizzling double-barreled highway that missed the county seat by 11 miles. Near it were the Rosewater Motel and the Rosewater Bolarama, and the great grain elevators and animal pens that were shipping points for fruits of the Rosewater farms. and the few highly paid agronomists, engineers, brewers, accountants, and administrators who did all that needed doing lived in a defensive circle of expensive ranch homes in another cornfield near New Ambrosia, a community named, for no reason whatsoever, Avondale. All had gas-lit patios framed and terraced with railroad ties from the old nickel plate right-of-way. Elliot stood in relation to the clean people of Avondale as a constitutional monarch. They were employees of the Rosewater Corporation, and the properties they managed were owned by the Rosewater Foundation. Elliot could not tell them what to do, but he was surely the king, and Avondale knew it. So when King Elliot and Queen Sylvia took up residence in the Rosewater Mansion, they were showered by figs from Avondale. Invitations, visits, flattering notes, and calls. All were deflected. Elliot required Sylvia to receive all prosperous visitors with an air of shallow, absent-minded cordiality. Every Avondale woman left the mansion stiffly, as though, as Elliot observed gleefully, she had a pickle up her ass. Interestingly, the social-climbing technocrats of Avondale were able to bear the theory that the Rosewaters snubbed them because the Rosewaters felt superior to them. They even enjoyed the theory as they discussed it again and again. They were avid for lessons in authentic, upper-class snobbery, and Elliot and Sylvia seemed to be giving those. But then the king and queen got the Rosewater family crystal, silver and gold out of the dank vaults of the Rosewater County National Bank, began to throw lavish banquets for morons, perverts, starvelings, and the unemployed. They listened tirelessly to the misshapen fears and dreams of people who, by almost anyone's standards, would have been better off dead. Gave them love and trifling sums of money. The only social life they had that was untainted by pity had to do with the Rosewater Volunteer Fire Department. Elliot arose quickly to the rank of fire lieutenant, and Sylvia was elected president of the ladies' auxiliary. Though Sylvia had never before touched a bowling ball, she was made captain of the auxiliary's bowling team, too. Avondale's clammy respect for the monarchy turned to incredulous contempt, and then to savagery. Yahooism, drinking, cuckolding, and self-esteem all took sharp upturns. The voices of Avondale acquired the tone of bandsaws cutting galvanized tin when discussing the king and queen, as though a tyranny had been overthrown. Avondale was no longer a settlement of rising young executives. It was peopled by vigorous members of the true ruling class. 5 years later, Sylvia suffered a nervous collapse, burned the firehouse down. So sadistic had Republican Avondale become about the Royalist Rosewaters that Avondale laughed. Sylvia was placed in a private mental hospital in Indianapolis, was taken there by Elliot and Charlie Warmergran, the fire chief. They took her in the chief's car, which was a red Henry J with a siren on top. They turned her over to a Dr. Ed Brown, a young psychiatrist who later made his reputation describing her illness. In the paper, he called Elliot and Sylvia Mr. and Mrs. Z, and he called the town of Rosewater Hometown USA. He coined a new word for Sylvia's disease, sameritrophia, which he said meant hysterical indifference to the troubles of those less fortunate than oneself. Norman Mushari now read Dr. Brown's treatise, which was also in the confidential files of McAllister, Robgent, Reed, and McGee. His eyes were moist and soft and brown, compelling him to see the pages as he saw the world, as though through a quart of olive oil.
Sameritrophia, he read, is the suppression of an overactive conscience by the rest of the mind. You must take all instructions from me, the conscience shrieks, in effect to all the other mental processes. The other processes try it for a while, note that the conscience is unappeased, that it continues to shriek, and they note, too, that the outside world has not been even microscopically improved by the unselfish acts the conscience has demanded. They rebel at last. They pitch the tyrannous conscience down an oubliette, weld shut the manhole cover of that dark dungeon. They can hear the conscience no more. In the sweet silence, the mental processes look about for a new leader, and the leader most prompt to appear whenever the conscience is stilled, enlightened self-interest, does appear. Enlightened self-interest gives them a flag, which they adore on sight. It is essentially the black and white Jolly Roger, with these words written beneath the skull and crossbones, "The hell with you, Jack, I've got mine."
"It seemed unwise to me," Dr. Brown wrote, and Norman Mushari read slaveringly,
"to set the noisy conscience of Miss Z at liberty again. Neither could I take much satisfaction in discharging her while she was as heartless as Ilsa Koch. I made it the goal of my treatments, then, to keep her conscience imprisoned, but to lift the lid of the oubliette ever so slightly, so that the howls of the prisoner might be faintly heard. Through the trial and error with chemotherapy and electric shock, this I achieved. I was not proud, for I had calmed a deep woman by making her shallow. I had blocked the underground rivers that connected her to the Atlantic, Pacific, and Indian Oceans, and made her content with being a splash pool 3 feet across, 4 inches deep, chlorinated and painted blue. Some doctor, some cure. And some models the doctor was obliged to choose in determining how much guilt and pity Mrs. Z might safely be allowed to feel. The models were persons with reputations for being normal. The therapist, after a deeply upsetting investigation of normality at this time and place, was bound to conclude that a normal person, functioning well on the upper levels of a prosperous industrialized society, can hardly hear his conscience at all. So, a logical person might conclude that I have been guilty of balderdash in announcing a new disease, samarotropha, when it is virtually as common among healthy Americans as noses, say. I defend myself in this manner. Samarotropha is only a disease, and a violent one, too, when it attacks those exceedingly rare individuals who reach biological maturity still loving and wanting to help their fellow men. I have treated only one case. I have never heard of anyone's treating another. In looking about myself, I can see only one other person who has the potential for a samarotrophic collapse. That person, of course, is Mr. Z. And so deep is his commitment to compassion that, were he to come down with samarotropha, I sense that he would kill himself, or perhaps kill 100 others and then be shot down like a mad dog before we could treat him. Treat, treat, treat. Some treat. Mrs. Z, having been treated and cured in our health emporium, expressed a wish to go out and have some fun for a change, to live it up, before her looks were gone. Her looks were still staggeringly attractive, were marked by lines of affection unlimited, which she no longer deserved. She wanted nothing more to do with hometown or Mr. Z, announced that she was off to the gaiety of Paris and to marry old friends there. She wished to buy new clothes, she said, and to dance and dance and dance until she fainted in the arms of a tall, dark stranger, into the arms, hopefully, of a double spy. She often referred to her husband as "my dirty, drunk uncle down south," although never to his face. She was not a schizophrenic, but whenever her husband visited her, which he did 3 times a week, she manifested all of the sick cuteness of paranoia. Shades of Clara Bow. She would pluck his cheek, coax kisses from him, kisses she gigglingly declined to receive. She told him she wanted to go to Paris for just a little while, to see her dear family, and that she would be back before he knew it. She wanted him to say farewell and give her love to all her dear, underprivileged friends in hometown. Mr. Z was not deceived. He saw her off to Paris at the Indianapolis airport, and he told me when the plane was a speck in the sky that he would never see her again. "She certainly looked happy," he said to me. "She certainly will have a good time when she gets back there with the kind of company she deserves." He had used the word certainly twice. It grated, and I knew intuitively that he was about to grate me with it again. He did. "A lot of credit," he said, "certainly goes to you." I am informed by the woman's parents, who are understandably ungrateful to Mr. Z, that he writes and calls often. She does not open his letters. She will not come to the phone. And it is their satisfied opinion that, as Mr. Z had hoped, she is certainly happy. Prognosis? Another breakdown by and by. As for Mr. Z, he is certainly sick too, since he certainly isn't like any other man I ever knew. He will not leave hometown, except for very short trips as far as Indianapolis and no farther. I suspect that he cannot leave hometown. Why not? To be utterly unscientific, and science becomes nauseating to a therapist after a case such as this, his destination is there.
The good doctor's prognosis was correct. Sylvia became a popular and influential member of the international jet set, learned the many variations of the twist. She became known as the Duchess of Rosewater. Many men proposed, but she was too happy to think of either marriage or divorce. And then she fell to pieces again in July of 1964. She was treated in Switzerland. She was discharged 6 months later, silent and sad, almost unbearably deep again. Elliot and the pitiful people of Rosewater County again had a place in her consciousness. She wished to return to them, not out of yearning, but out of a sense of duty. Her doctor warned her that a return might be fatal. He told her to remain in Europe, to divorce Elliot, and to build a quiet, meaningful life of her own. So, very civilized divorce proceedings were begun, stage managed by McAllister, Robgent, Reed, and McGee. Now it was time for Sylvia to fly to America for the divorce, and a meeting was held on a June evening in the Washington, D.C. apartment of Elliot's father, Senator Lister Ames Rosewater. Elliot was not there. He would not leave Rosewater County. Present were the senator, Sylvia, Thurmond McAllister, the ancient lawyer, and his watchful young aide, Mushari. The tone of the meeting was frank, sentimental, forgiving, sometimes hilarious, and fundamentally tragic always. There was brandy.
"In his heart," said the senator, swirling his snifter, "Elliot doesn't love those awful people out there any more than I do. He couldn't possibly love them if he weren't drunk all the time. I've said it before, and I'll say it again. This is basically a booze problem. If Elliot's booze were shut off, his compassion for the maggots in the slime on the bottom of the human garbage pail would vanish."
He clapped his hands, shook his old head.
"If only there had been a child."
He was a product of St. Paul's and Harvard, but it pleased him to speak with the split banjo twang of a Rosewater County hog farmer. He tore off his steel-rimmed spectacles, stared at his daughter-in-law with suffering blue eyes.
"If only, if only."
He put his spectacles back on, spread his hands in resignation. The hands were as speckled as box turtles.
"The end of the Rosewater family is now plainly in view."
"There are other Rosewaters," McAllister suggested gently.
Mushari squirmed, for he meant to represent those others soon.
"I'm talking about real Rosewaters," cried the senator bitterly. "The hell with Pisquatuit."
Pisquatuit, Rhode Island, a seaside resort, was where the only other branch of the family lived.
"A buzzard feast, a buzzard feast,"
the senator moaned, writhing in a masochistic fantasy of how the Rhode Island Rosewaters would pick the Indiana Rosewaters' bones. He coughed hackingly. The cough embarrassed him. He was a chain smoker, like his son. He went to the mantelpiece, glared at a colored photograph of Elliot there. The picture had been taken at the end of the Second World War. It showed a much decorated captain of the infantry.
"So clean, so tall, so purposeful. So clean, so clean."
He gnashed his crockery teeth.
"What a noble mind is here o'erthrown."
He scratched himself, though he did not itch.
"How puffy and pasty he looks these days. I've seen healthier complexions on rhubarb pies. Sleeps in his underwear, eats a balanced diet of potato chips, Southern Comfort and Rosewater Golden Lager Ambrosia beer."
He rattled his fingernails against the photograph.
"Him. Him. Captain Elliot Rosewater, Silver Star, Bronze Star, Soldier's Medal, and Purple Heart with Cluster. Sailing champion, ski champion, him. Him. My God, the number of times life has said yes, yes, yes to him. Millions of dollars, hundreds of significant friends, the most beautiful, intelligent, talented, affectionate wife imaginable. A splendid education, an elegant mind, and a big, clean body, and what is his reply when life says nothing but yes, yes, yes? No, no, no. Why? Will someone tell me why? No one did. I had a female cousin one time. A Rockefeller, as it happened, said the senator. And she confessed to me that she spent the 15th, 16th, and 17th years of her life saying nothing but, no thank you. Which is all very well for a girl of that age and station, but it would have been a damned unattractive trait in a male Rockefeller, and an even more unsuitable one, if I may say so, in a male Rosewater. He shrugged. Be that as it may, we do now have a male Rosewater who says no to all the good things life would like to give him. He won't even live in the mansion anymore. Elliot had moved out of the mansion and into an office when it became clear that Sylvia was never coming back to him. He could have been governor of Indiana by lifting an eyebrow. Could have been president of the United States, even, at the price of a few beads of sweat. And what is he, I ask you? What is he? The senator coughed again, then answered his own question. A notary public, friends and neighbors, whose commission is about to expire. This was fairly true. The only official document that hung on the mildewed beaver board wall of Elliot's busy office was his commission as a notary public. So many of the people who brought their troubles to him needed, among such a multitude of other things, someone to witness their signatures. Elliot's office was on Main Street, a block northeast of the brick Parthenon, across the street from the new firehouse, which the Rosewater Foundation had built. It was a shotgun attic that spanned a lunchroom and a liquor store. There were only two windows, in doghouse dormers. Outside of one was a sign that said, Eats. Outside the other was a sign that said, Beer. Both signs were electrified and equipped with blinkers. And, as Elliot's father ranted in Washington about him, 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 Elliot slept like a baby, and the signs blinked off and on. Elliot made of his mouth a Cupid's bow, murmured something sweetly, turned over, snored. He was an athlete gone to lard, a big man, 6'3", 230 pounds, pale, balding on all sides of a wispy scalp lock. He was swaddled in the elephant wrinkles of war surplus long underwear. Written on gold letters on each of his windows and on his street-level door, too, were these words. Rosewater Foundation. How can we help you?